Okay, here I am with Cameron, starting our third session. And Cameron would like to talk about an interesting theme he finds that I bring up that he has thought a lot about. It's the cul-de-sac theme. So lead off with that, Cameron.
Okay, so when I was an undergraduate, I got very interested in Nietzsche. One of the professors at Princeton was Walter Kaufmann, who has done more translation of Nietzsche than anybody else, I believe, and who wrote a influential monograph on Nietzsche in the 1950s. And at least for a few decades, he was sort of the dean of Nietzsche interpretation in the United States. So I didn't always agree with Kaufman's take on Nietzsche, but I was certainly spurred to read Nietzsche and to think about him. And at Princeton, you have to write an undergraduate thesis, and I ended up doing my thesis on the second untimely meditation of Nietzsche. At the time, I couldn't speak German, so I was working in translations, but my interest in Nietzsche was one of the factors that led me to go and study in German in Germany and to learn German there. And I've remained highly interested in Nietzsche ever since, and often discuss Nietzsche in my blog. So one of the
okay, when are you at Princeton and studying Nietzsche? Late 60s?
Yeah, well, I graduated in 66, so the middle 60s.
Okay. And when did you go to Germany or learn German?
I went to Germany in 1970 and studied German there as a second language in Munich. And then for the next 30 or so years, I was regularly in Germany again, and gradually came to be able to think in German or dream in German, which is that's sort of the test if you know another language well.
Okay. Now, didn't you visit McLuhan in 1970?
Yeah, although I now think it must have been the fall of 68.
Okay, so you're thinking you've graduated in 66. You're thinking, where do I go next? You're interested in McLuhan. Did we ever talk about how you discovered McLuhan? How did you become aware of him in that period?
Actually, while I was still at Princeton, my dad brought up McLuhan. My dad was a great nationalist, you could say, so that any time he ran across somebody who was a Canadian and seemed noteworthy, he would phone me or write me a letter and bring it up. And through him, I began to read a few things of McLuhan. I think he might even have sent me McLuhan Hot and Cool after it was published in the middle 60s.
Well, that was published in 67.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so now I remember, it may not have been on the recorded part, the one where our first session that got aborted. And now I remember you telling me how your father would turn you on to different things. And
yes, sir.
He wouldn't read McLuhan himself, but he thought it was good for you, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. So you find McLuhan in 67, 68. And you said you visited him in 68?
Yes, sir. So I had already, by the time I visited McLuhan, I had read a fair amount of him. I can't remember in detail exactly which books I had read, but I had read enough that I thought it would be interesting to study with him.
Right. Now, this is a dramatic point because you get turned off by the scene, and that leaves you open to do Nietzsche. If you had not been repulsed by the scene, no more Nietzsche, maybe.
Well, I had already been very interested in Nietzsche, so it was one of the things that I brought up with McLuhan in person was a topic I often deal with in the blog, and that is I tried to convince or at least to interest McLuhan in the idea that there were problems in philosophy that had existed at least since the time of Nietzsche that his work might answer. But he wasn't interested at all. He just seemed to indicate that, well, that's conceptual thinking or something like that.
Okay.
But I think about it.
Okay, go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to say that one of the reasons I think this was the fall of 68 was that McLuhan's handlers, if you will, were asking him very, very easy questions and very repetitive questions. And I thought this indicated a lack of thinking or just a lack of curiosity at the center. But in retrospect, I'm thinking maybe they were trying to re-engage McLuhan's mind following his operation in New York.
Yes. Now, would that the Watsons were there, weren't they?
Not that I remember. Not that I remember.
You didn't know the people around. You don't know who the handlers were, so to speak.
Well, I knew his brother was there. I knew Eric was there.
Harley Parker.
That I don't remember.
Okay, so yeah, that's right. It's a year later from his surgery, but he's very sensitive to noises, and yeah, maybe we have the recordings of him with Tony Schwartz through 68, and he sounds pretty normal, you know, even though he had surgery just a few months before.
Yes, but I've seen some interviews of him, maybe through you, where he actually sounds quite acute not too long after the operation.
Yes.
Surprisingly acute.
Yeah. Yes.
But he sounded anything but acute when I was there.
Okay. So there was something dull. Handicapped was the vibe around him.
Yeah. That's what it seemed to me. It may have been a stupid observation on my part, but that's what I felt, and I just gave up on the idea of trying to work with him.
And is that based on visiting two or three times, or just one time in that period, that week, that year?
Well, I had a good friend in Toronto with whom I was staying. And I suppose over a week's time, I was at the center maybe four or five times.
Right. So you had a chance to observe it. And did you experience a Monday night seminar? Public
not
seminar?
Not a Monday night seminar, but a afternoon seminar.
Mm, yeah.
Some sort of graduate seminar, supposedly. But, man, it was just so dull and so unimaginative compared to seminars that I'd experienced at Princeton that I just thought, well, you know, this isn't something I can do.
Yeah, and it was slow. You knew McLuhan had surgery at the time?
That I can't remember, but I don't think I did.
Right. And now it's slow because the students didn't understand what McLuhan was saying.
Well, it just, what I remember is that McLuhan would say to students, well, you know, what's the new word? And then the students would sort of go around, and one would say, oh, the twist, or another one would say psychedelic or something, right?
Yeah.
And eventually, and McLuhan wouldn't really react. And then finally a word would come up and he'd say, yes, that's the word. And he would begin to talk about it or something, right? And I tried to ask, well, you know, how do you decide what the word is? Right? And he would either get angry or, you know, ignore it. So.
At you. He'd get angry at you for asking that.
Yeah. Or, I mean, not really angry.
Right. Just a little irritated.
You know, dismissive.
So it was an odd vibration between you two the whole time, right?
Yep. That's right.
Yeah, out of
That's
sync.
Right.
Okay, so
yeah, yeah.
So you, when you go and do Nietzsche in Germany in 70, are you still watching McLuhan? And, you know, a freak cliche archetype comes out in 71, Counterblast in 69, Cultures Are Business in 70. Were you aware of those books coming out?
I can't remember the exact titles I was reading. I doubt that I read them all, but some of them, definitely.
Right. So you kept following McLuhan book-wise, and you had no
yes,
desire
sir.
To go back to the coach house.
Right.
So now we come to the point here is that the cul-de-sac idea you have and you've become aware of in the mid-60s or in 70 when studying Nietzsche. So let's talk about the cul-de-sac as Nietzsche presented it.
Right. So for Nietzsche, the entire Western civilization entered a cul-de-sac with Plato, basically. And then civilization goes through six steps through which it discovers that it's in a cul-de-sac.
You're saying the time of Plato is a cul-de-sac?
Yeah, already. Yeah.
Nietzsche says that.
Yes. So in his History of an Error, which is basically the traversing of the cul-de-sac of Western thought, he begins with Plato. So the first step in this cul-de-sac is I, Plato, am the truth.
Mm.
And he and Nietzsche sets out six steps and then comments on each one. And with the I, Plato, am the truth, Nietzsche's comment is that this makes sense, that this is sort of a good idea. But progressing from there presents problems, right? So when he gets up to Kant, let's say, at the end of the 18th century, he says that Western thought now does not believe that it can get in touch with the thing in itself, but it believes that the thing in itself can still be directive. Can still supply some sort of ethic. And he calls that a pale Königsbergian fog. And these Königsberg is where Kant taught and lived.
Right.
So,
okay.
Yeah,
so what are the six phases historically? What's phase two? Is that's past Plato, right?
Yeah. I'll have to...
I'm looking at your note you sent me. Progress of the idea, it becomes more cunning, more insidious, more incomprehensible. It becomes a woman. It becomes Christian.
Right. So they, after Plato, the second step would be that the church develops a theology based on the truth, but the truth is no longer something immediate. As it might be thought to be with Plato, it's now mediated through the church and through church dogma, through the sacraments, etc. And Nietzsche regards this as a feminization of the idea, because it's kind of Plato with makeup, if you will.
Yes. Okay, we don't want to go into much detail. So what's phase three?
Right.
The old sun in the background, Nordic and Königsbergian.
Right. So that's what I mentioned before. At the end of the 17th century, possibility that humans can relate to what Kant called the thing in itself is denied, but the thing in itself is still regarded as a directive for thought, as something that thought can aim at, and even as something that can supply some sort of ethic.
Okay, now each phases are updatings of the cul-de-sac.
Correct. It's advancing into the cul-de-sac.
What was that word? Man. Man seeing into the cul-de-sac. Is that what you said?
No, advancing into.
Oh.
Each step is a step of advance into the cul-de-sac until the cul-de-sac becomes plain as what it is.
Yeah, but is Plato in a cul-de-sac?
Well, we have the same problem here, Bob, where if we say, was there tactility in the Gutenberg galaxy? Well, there was tactility, but it didn't know it. It was the attempt to think aside from tactility, but in order to do so, it had to implicate tactility, right?
Yes.
So the Nietzsche's notion of the cul-de-sac is that it begins with Plato, but Plato didn't engage with that idea. Plato didn't perceive that he was going into or was taking this road that had no exit.
Okay, so the cul-de-sac is what is going to be Nietzsche's time in full.
Yes,
full bloom.
Absolutely.
That's right. So then you've got the cock crow of positivism. That's the 19th century?
Right. Yes, the beginning of the 19th century, Comte, in the later part of the 19th century. It's the idea that the thing in itself that we're supposedly given direction by and yet can't grasp is useless, right? What's the use of an idea that we can never have? Right? And so he calls that the cock crow of positivism, is to realize that the thing in itself, or truth, or God, is unreachable, and therefore we should get rid of it.
Okay, did we talk about the chemical elements last time?
Yes, we did. Not in this context, but we did talk about them, and certainly the era that we're talking about here was also the era of the chemical elements being discovered.
Right. So how do you relate that to what Nietzsche's noticing? Is there any connection?
That's a good question. It has several answers. Chemistry had a great boom all during the 19th century. But at the end of the 19th century, chemistry, physics became aware of difficulties that they didn't know how to solve, right? So chemistry was based on the atom, but nobody knew what the atom was. So the discovery of the atom and the atomic structure and the electron and all that stuff, that comes at the beginning of the 20th century. And at the end of the 19th century, the problems with trying to discover what the atom was in physics trying to discover if there was an ether that light could travel through and that bore the waves of light. That was a problem in physics. So you could say that the hard sciences, as well as the humanities, entered into a cul-de-sac in the latter part of the 19th century.
Okay, now remember we brought up McLuhan's biological metaphor. And is McLuhan saying biology replaces physics and chemistry as a framer of Western thought?
I don't know about that, but my impression of some of your stuff is that you don't mind saying something close to that.
That's right? Right.
You like the idea of some kind of a collective biology taking over.
Yes, the chemical body, I call it.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Is that the chemical body or is that?
No, that's the chemical body.
Yeah,
that's the beginning of, you know, Claude Bernard and the interior landscape and the bag of chemicals, McLuhan calls it. Human body's a bag of chemicals, and Western chemical physics and biological knowledge dominates the world. That's the Western imperialism going into the 20th century.
Right.
So I
guess I would...
Go ahead.
I was thinking of your advance from there, that at least my impression is that you find biology, the organic life in entities that are not the entities of regular science. They're the media themselves, you could say. They're forces that are anything but chemical.
Yes. Okay, let's just put that aside for a second and finish this.
Sure.
This cul-de-sac at the end of the 19th century you just described, that's Nietzsche's time. Does he talk, like you still got 4, 5, and 6, are they part of Nietzsche's thinking, the cul-de-sac?
Oh, yes. Yeah, absolutely. So we actually did talk about 4, which is positivism, which is to say that what we can see and touch hear is all there is.
Yes.
There isn't any thing in itself that lies beyond all of this, right?
So and that's what I mean by biology as a framer. You know, we get the extreme of materialistic atheism or science saying this is all there is, what we come up with.
Correct.
And then, you know, what's left over religion is the anti-environment to that. But the early 20th century brings in an interest in retrieval of occult systems as a counter to positivism. Now, Nietzsche went into that stuff, didn't he?
Well, I don't know about if he went into the occult. Nietzsche went insane in 1990 and died... 1890, absolutely. And
when did he die?
He died, I think, in just after 1900. I don't know if he died in 1900, 1901, 1902.
Okay, I can look that up. But let's five and six. He's dealing with this. What does he come up with? Two more developments of closer completion of an impenetrable cul-de-sac or something. What is he doing?
Well, you mentioned that second half of the 19th century was sort of the high tide of materialism.
Yes.
People thinking that they had a good handle on what the real was, and by thinking about the real as materialism, they would make the same advances in the humanities and social sciences as the hard sciences had made, thinking about the same thing.
Yes.
So What Nietzsche says is that the step five is that there's no real reason to call this reality. It's just before we could say reality was the thing in itself or God or truth or something. But now what we're saying is that all of these entities sort of fall away, and all we have is what we perceive, what we can touch, materialism. And so Nietzsche says, then people said, if what we used to call reality is gone, why are we transferring that to materialism? Why don't we say that materialism is just one possibility that we in the West might entertain, but there's nothing any more true or real about this materialism of ours than there is about any other conception, right? So let's just drop reality and say that we're dealing with some fairly subjective notion for reasons of utility or something, right?
Right. So you're including five and six, the way you've laid it out here, in what you just said.
No, not really, because the decisive step in six, and it's here that I think there's a relation with your notion of the cul-de-sac, is that Nietzsche says we've done away with the real world, and so all we have left is the apparent world, the world that appears to us, that we can touch and hear and smell. But he says, if all we have is the apparent world, then we have no world. So the apparent world also disappears. And the logic behind this is that in order to specify what the apparent world is, there has to be some real factor. So, for example, a poet can specify something as real, but the poet can only specify something as real if the poet has reality. And if we're withdrawing reality from everything, including from the poet, then there's no way to specify what's real, and everything just dissolves.
Okay. Is that those writings, I guess that's the end of his writing, those are those later stages, is that when he's considered
Correct.
Insane?
No, that's two or three years before that. Nietzsche was writing with a fever pitch before he went insane, and I think he published four or five books in the late 1880s, just before he collapsed.
Okay, so since I've engaged second sight people who seem to have it, Michael Blake Reed was a medium for the Evergreens that McLuhan went to in 1976. I discovered Michael in 1980 and then did many sessions, 64 sessions for over 24 years, most of them $500 each. So I spent a lot of money on him. But at one point, I could talk to any dead person I wanted, and I did many people, including hours with McLuhan. But I did Nietzsche. And Nietzsche said that he faked the insanity because he was sick of his audience, sick of attention. He didn't want his fame anymore, and he just wanted to be left alone. So he put up that wall. Maybe on the other side, he was coming up with an alibi for his silly behavior. I don't know, but that's an interesting thing that. And Mark Stallman was part of that session, I think. And Mark thought that was pretty interesting. So you have that. Now, one night in a McLuhan seminar, Monday night seminar, he was talking to somebody, and I was standing there eavesdropping. And he started going on about how Nietzsche studied effects. He was almost saying Nietzsche was an early mediaecologist. Does that make sense to you, that McLuhan would say that?
Yes, it does. It's McLuhan, to me, is can be frustrating at times because he'll say something and you'll think, well, you know, that's a kind of an interesting statement, but then it's hard to follow it up. And so I spend a fair amount of time at the blog looking through McLuhan's writings and trying to specify things that he says in terms of quotations taken out of his books and interviews over many years.
Okay. All right, so the cul-de-sac, as a McLuhanite, I look at these six phases, and I can see the technology of the day creating an environment. You know, it's easy to project media dynamics on each phase, right?
Yeah, it's easier for you than for me.
Okay, that's a good point, because you do remain stuck at the cul-de-sac.
Well, maybe.
But
that's why when you say that, that's one more reason that I'm very interested to know how you see the cul-de-sac.
Yeah, how'd I get out of it?
See it differently. Yeah. Well, my whole idea of McLuhan that I even presented to him is that he does have ideas to get out of it. But I don't know that you and I have the same view of that.
Okay, you presented that to McLuhan?
Yes, of course.
Okay.
Because I had.
Was it the cul-de-sac idea? Did you talk?
Yes.
Use those words?
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, I don't know. I could have talked about the general problem of Western civilization, of losing meaning, of losing orientation. But it would have come directly from Nietzsche because that's what I had done my thesis on. And my whole approach to McLuhan was that I thought that the work I had done on Nietzsche and the work I had done on Thomas Kuhn on the structure of scientific revolutions brought an interesting angle to his work. And as I say, he just dismissed that as conceptual stuff.
Right. So let's... you didn't understand McLuhan that well at that time. You maybe thought you did, but you've learned a lot more over the last 40 years, right?
Yes, sir.
And you have a deeper understanding of McLuhan. Would you still present what you presented in 68 to him, that Nietzsche solved or gave some indications of solving the cul-de-sac? And applying it to McLuhan? Whatever you said, would you still say that today?
I think so, yes.
Okay, well, let's hear it then. Let's hear a little bit about what he thought was conceptual.
All right. Well, remember that I'm at the same time that I'm talking about this stuff, I'm aware that you have a different conception of the cul-de-sac and a different conception of how to get out of it, and I'm very interested in hearing about that.
Okay.
But if we take my view, then it is that Nietzsche defined the cul-de-sac but did not define a way out of it, at least in my view. So what Nietzsche did was he described how Western thought had come to nullity, you might say. How Western thought had found reality just turned to dust in its hand and had no way of finding something firm again. Right. So, with as a possible answer to that, and by the way, this relates to McLuhan's reading of Burroughs. Because I think there were parts of what Burroughs had to say in that same TLS issue with McLuhan in 1964, I think Burroughs brought things to mind for McLuhan that he much appreciated.
Yes.
And one of the things that he talks about is he mentions a couple times, forget me. And what he's saying there as a literary technique is that you don't write from the eye.
Who
instead,
says this? Is this
Burroughs?
Burroughs
this
says
is in
that.
Burroughs.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. Don't write from the eye. Right.
Correct. So, listen to the murmur of the voices that are coming to you. Right. Not what you are writing on your typewriter for others.
Yes.
And this is very close to what McLuhan had discovered with André Girard in 1958, namely the distinction between light through, which is light coming towards us, as opposed to light on, which is light coming from us.
Yes.
Okay.
Well,
so
light on is reflecting off the page. Is that light coming from us?
Well, the distinction is light through as through a stained glass window,
yeah,
and light on, which is what we produce, what we certify, right? But the whole mechanism of the cul-de-sac for Nietzsche turns on the idea that reality, once there is no such thing as an objective thing in itself, or God, or a dogma that people simply accept. Once there is no objective marker, then reality depends upon subjective certification. And then Nietzsche says, well, but if subjective certification itself depends upon reality, then there is no subjective certification, therefore there is no reality. End of story. So
now, are you saying that Nietzsche used the terms light on and light through?
No. I'm saying that that difference, which McLuhan came across in late 1958 in New York, that difference is one way of explicating what was going on with Nietzsche.
Okay.
It's imported to him, in my view.
Right.
Remember, we're talking about the cul-de-sac and how we can get out of it.
Yes. Now, it seems obvious to me, through my McLuhan bias, that Nietzsche was talking about percept, and he had given up the conceptual, the book culture. Isn't he arguing just with books?
I think that's a good way of putting it, but without turning to percepts. I mean, you're putting your finger exactly on the way out of the cul-de-sac.
Yeah.
And that is to turn to percepts, but not percepts as my production, rather percepts as coming to me. Right?
Yeah, that's
so
light on.
That's what McLuhan calls light through.
Okay, coming to me. All right.
Right. Right. And what's interesting about percepts is that they are inherently plural. Right. So we mentioned this whole idea when we were talking about the Paleolithic hunter.
Yes.
In our last conversation, right, where the Paleolithic hunter has percepts that come to him as ways of understanding what he or she is looking at. Right, and that's different from developing concepts and interrogating the objective world through some kind of making precise through the subject.
Okay, so McLuhan says the literate eye is a passive eye. Light bounces off things and comes to him. you're saying light through is light coming to the observer. That's the definition of the passive eye, the non-broadcasting eye. The primitive eye broadcasts. Have you seen those ideas? Carpenter does them, and I think, and they became what they beheld.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I mean, what you're saying is true. It's just that these terms can be used in different ways in different contexts.
Okay, so right, when you're saying that you don't mean, when you say light on, no, light through comes to me,
right.
That's not the passive literate eye.
No, absolutely not. The percepts are inherently plural, and the literate eye that finds itself dissolving through its own questions and through practical problems that it can't solve, that literate eye depends upon perceptions that it doesn't acknowledge.
Mm.
It builds conceptions on top of perceptions that then hide the perceptions.
Right. Okay.
Right? So
Nietzsche didn't fully understand that, so he didn't move into percept, is what you're saying.
Yes.
And now in Verbi Vocal Visual, 1957, McLuhan comments on Wittgenstein, who came to the edge but refused to jump into the abyss. You remember that sentence?
Vaguely, yes. I know it's there.
That sounds like the same criticism you're making of Nietzsche. He couldn't jump into the abyss of percept.
Yeah, so, I mean, what's the abyss? The abyss is the gap of transformation.
Acoustic,
right?
Space.
And the thing that I learned from you the last time, or that emerged in my brain from our conversation, put it that way, is that the difference between visual space and acoustic space is the difference between light through, that is to say, perceptions coming to us, because the ear doesn't have the same kind of active function as the eye, right? So you have the ear is the organ of light through, and the eye is the organ of light on. And ultimately, McLuhan will want to say you need both, but coming out of the 19th century, the great need was to understand and to live in the acoustic world as supplying potential answers to the cul-de-sac.
Right. And would you say that the men of 1914, Lewis, not so much Yeats maybe, but Eliot, Pound, and Joyce, they did get into percept that Nietzsche couldn't do? Isn't that what McLuhan claims?
I think so, although all of these people, and also including McLuhan, have the problem that it's one thing to vaguely understand something, it's another thing to make it precise, and it's especially another thing to be able to communicate it. And our whole present world situation tells us that that communication has not been achieved.
Okay, so but McLuhan, he comes to the technology, and I guess we can see it in Joyce and Eliot and Pound. They see the technological factor, and definitely in Lewis. So did McLuhan figure something out that Joyce and them didn't figure out?
Maybe. I think in his own mind, he'd probably say that it was necessary to be religious in ways that most of them didn't understand. Maybe
right.
Eliot did, but Pound and Lewis and Joyce did not.
Yeah, did you say maybe Pound? Maybe Pound?
No, that McLuhan thought Eliot was on the right track by turning to religion, but that Lewis, Pound, and Joyce were on a wrong path.
Right.
Ultimately, yeah.
Okay, so now the cul-de-sac that Nietzsche's talking about, we now know what you're referring to. What did you say to McLuhan that Nietzsche contributes to what you thought McLuhan had figured out?
That I thought that by looking at Nietzsche, that McLuhan's contribution could be clarified, and people would understand its importance.
The importance of McLuhan.
Yeah.
Because Nietzsche had a certain weight.
Yes. Well, had a weight, but not as a guy with not X million mentions in academic papers or something like that, but as a guy who articulated the fate of the modern world.
The what of the modern world?
Fate.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I see McLuhan dismissing all book culture because the Electric Age just wiped it out. And he had to be careful talking that way. But we found him really blatantly doing it to the art critics in 1970, right? We talked about that in the last session.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, most...
But remember, when it's one thing for book culture to be wiped out, it's another thing to recall all at onceness, where book culture has its equal claim with every other kind of culture.
Right. So there's the cul-de-sac McLuhan was in.
How do you mean?
Remember he said in Playboy, a world that is dead, but we can't let go of it, and we can't get to a world that's powerless to be born. Do you remember that?
Yeah. Yes, and that's a sentiment that was very common in the 1920s. I remember there's a quote from Rilke, right? And we are such disinherited children to whom no longer what's been and not yet what's coming belongs. That's the English translation. I can't recall the German off the top of my head, but that idea that we are disinherited children was used by Erich Heller. I don't know if you remember that guy from the 50s and 60s, but quite an acute observer of the
scene. You mean
scene.
The San Francisco longshoreman?
No. That was, you're right that it was Erich something, but not Heller.
Oh,
who's
Erich Heller? I don't know Erich Heller.
Yeah, he wrote a book called The Disinherited Mind.
Oh, okay.
Which I thought was excellent in defining the cul-de-sac.
Okay, so what was I going to say there? You were, thought just before that. They were the 1920s, they were called the Lost Generation, right?
Absolutely.
And, you know, that's so perfect in retrospect. They're all disembodied, discarnate in the radio world, which is an amazing new medium. And that'll loosen your bearings.
Yeah.
And then politically, look what happened. I mean, huge, you know, retrieve tribalism or mass man at the speed of light.
Sure.
That's going to intimidate that generation.
Sure. But this reminds me of something you said in our last recording, and you were referring to contemporary times and saying that the effect of the cul-de-sac now was going to be felt in civil wars.
Yeah.
And I think you're right. I think when people are disinherited and lost, they become desperate to find a way out.
Yep.
And so the potentially great contribution of somebody like McLuhan would be to show that there's a way out that doesn't involve violence.
Yeah.
Right? And so McLuhan over and over again talks about how if you're lost, you tend to become violent, and that if we are to solve problems of violence in the modern world, we have to secure identities, right? And this
yeah.
is almost, this topic right here is what I tried to present to McLuhan either in the very late 60s or 1970, but he was not interested.
Well, their terms were wrong. Right?
I'm not trying to claim any credit. I should have pursued the idea. I should have just stayed in Toronto, and I didn't have to study with the guy. I could have just gone to seminars. I didn't have to go to University of Toronto. I should have done something like what you did.
Yes. Yeah. I knew one had to keep hanging around him because he had more to unfold.
Right.
I knew that. But the You just said you went in 68 and 70. You weren't sure which the date was. It's a one-time visit for a week.
Right. Yes,
and you think it's late 68. Now, you just jumped to 70. It's not 70. It's 1968, right?
Well, I think so. The reason I brought in 70 is that I don't have any firm anchor that I can say this was 68 or
yeah.
this was 69 or 70. But I'm pretty sure it was 68.
Okay. So we are witnessing this week. The drama of what we're reviewing is really blatant right now in the
yes,
King,
sir.
The King
yes.
of the Mountain, you know, America. It's pretty incredible. So let's
yes.
try to be let's try to help the situation with what we think we got here. Okay, so we got a cul-de-sac.
Yeah.
The powerless to be born and the inability to forget, to drop the past,
right.
That's a good quote, right?
Absolutely.
And
Absolutely.
It might come from someone else. I'm not sure. In my mind, I think he was quoting someone else, but if you know where he said it other than there, maybe it was his.
Yeah, so let me just read a sentence that I sent you an email, but I probably sent you too much email for you to have gone into this stuff in any detail.
Yes,
but,
I'm actually right in the middle of the crisis in the White House. I'm a direct advisor to it.
Uh-huh. All right.
Here's a neat anecdote. Do you know who Sidney Powell is?
Of course.
Okay, so you're not totally ignoring the news. You're up on the characters.
This morning before our conversation, I read the lawsuit that she filed in Georgia.
Oh, I didn't know it. So she did do it yesterday. Well, I'm still doing Wednesday.
Late.
You know, I haven't gone to bed yet.
So it was late last night. She filed in both Georgia and Michigan. Both are, one of them is 100 pages and one of them is 75. And she introduces a lot of evidence concerning mathematical improbabilities, probable software manipulation, gaps in the security of the machines, gaps in the security of the ballots themselves, etc. So it'll be very interesting to see what happens. Yeah.
And did she get any coverage in the ABC CNN world?
Well, I don't know, but I never watched that stuff.
Oh, okay.
So,
well, that's the issue. They won't cover her. But maybe
right.
they have to now.
Of course they won't.
Okay.
Nah.
So listen
to this. They'll just ignore it.
Okay, so my assistant in Georgia you know, as part of our business. And he got an email out of the blue from Lynn Wood and Sidney Powell. Now, I know how they would have found out about him, because they are aware of me and Carol and my partner in Atlanta that is meets with Trump occasionally. He got an email asking them to come to the one of their offices, Lynn Woods or Sidney. This is Wednesday, and when he gets there, the first thing Sidney says is, "Bob going to help us save Trump?" That was her question on her big day. And so I heard about this later, but my assistant said, "Well, I don't know what he would say to that. I didn't know he'd ask that. He doesn't know he'd ask that. He didn't know, so I have to get back to him, and then I'll tell you." So then I told him, "Sure, yeah, I'll help." So there's levels of involvement here that are too strange in this concept, in this context. But they do involve second sight, so that's another point here. Sidney Powell is very aware of what we do, what I do, the scandalous stuff that I do on the radio. And it's an amazing story, but I don't want to get distracted, but that's what I mean. I'm directly involved in the drama of what's going on.
Good.
So, let's get back to the ivory tower quickly.
Yeah, but the thing of it is that just as in the 20s, the ivory tower is deeply implicated in practical affairs, because the cul-de-sac into which the ivory tower has collapsed is spreading into practical affairs in a way that's very dangerous.
Yes, and the ivory tower is what I used to call the solar government, you know, Echelon, the satellites around the planet that are organized for espionage purposes or maybe other stuff too, by New Zealand, America, Britain, and Canada. You know about Echelon?
Yeah. So that's the five I's.
Yes.
When I write it, I don't write five EYE, I write five AYE.
And what's that, the British saying I in Parliament?
Well, just I meaning yes.
Yeah,
meaning
the four yeses, five yeses.
Exactly, just whatever you say, sir.
Okay, as we talk, so there was the cul-de-sac of Nietzsche's time. Then there's the cul-de-sac that goes further than Nietzsche because there's newer technology in the men of 1914's time. Then there's the cul-de-sac of McLuhan's time, and then we have our cul-de-sac. And my story in this, what we're reviewing, I bring it to the tech body, which is a very dramatic phenomenon if it's real, right? This is an incredible cul-de-sac. Now, you tend to say that every generation or school of thought doesn't get out of the cul-de-sac, or they don't want to. You talk about this in different ways in your blog, right?
Yes, sir. Yeah.
So,
but it's a very, very complex thing that is more complicated than an inability or an undesirability or something like that. It's a kind of fate of the world. And how to think about it is deeply embedded in the whole problem.
Okay, so I run through six phases. Nietzsche's dealing with the global village cul-de-sac and all the different media dynamics of that era.
Well, let me, Bob, if I can, what I'd like to do is I'd like to indicate a place in your book.
Okay.
That nicely brings out what Nietzsche was talking about.
Okay,
so
good.
On page 50,
Okay.
You have a quotation at the near the top of the page from McLuhan's notes on Burroughs. This is page 50 of your book. It's 52 of PDF.
This is the one that begins, Burroughs disdains the hallucinatory drugs, or the other one?
No, this is page 50, and Joyce was sure he had worked out a formula.
I have it.
For total.
Okay, good.
Okay, good. So, Joyce, I'll just read two things. One is from McLuhan on Burroughs, and that's from December 28th. 1964. So he must have written it in November or October or something of 64, which is a couple months after he and Burroughs had appeared in the Times Literary Supplement in, I think it was
August. Yeah.
It was August. Yeah.
Yep.
Okay. So he says, Joyce was sure he had worked out a formula for total cultural understanding and control. The idea of art is total programming for the environment. It's tribal, mental, Egyptian. It is also an idea of art to which electric technology leads quite strongly. We live science fiction. The bomb is our environment.
That's one of my favorite quotes.
Okay, good. So let me read another one for you.
But remember, he says, like Burroughs. You didn't say that part. Like Burroughs, Joyce was sure he had worked out the formula.
Oh, yeah. Okay, sorry. You've got a couple things in quotation marks there. Yeah.
Yes.
Interesting. Okay, good. So what I'm going to read you now came from Andrew Crystal, I believe, and was something that... you have on your website, and it's a letter to Wilfred Watson from October 1964. So it's written just at the same time that McLuhan must have been writing his notes on Burroughs.
Yes.
And you'll see that it overlaps with it very strongly. He says, talk about blind spots in regions of maximal impact. Looking at the diabolical principle just now, that was a 1931 book of Wyndham Lewis. Looking at the diabolical principle just now, I read loud and clear that art must be totally environmental. It must be the content of nothing whatsoever. Ergo, the vortex equals total involvement equals Lewis wants nothing less for art than the power to create total environments for life and death. There must be no art as content of some other set of skills or interests. I find it a bit staggering to confront Lewis as a man who really wanted to be Pontifex Maximus of a magical priesthood. I suppose Yeats, Joyce, and Pound had similar aspirations. Their priesthood was to create new worlds of perception. They were to be world engineers who shaped the totality of human awareness. Their pigments and materials were not to be paint or words, but all the resources of the age. Such were the pharaohs. They made of the world a perception lab. Now,
amazing. Wilfred Watson.
Yeah. And both of them talk about Lewis. Both of them talk about Egypt, and both of them talk about, unknowingly, talk about Nietzsche's idea of the cul-de-sac. Because
You're saying both of them. You mean Watson in his response?
No, I mean
Burroughs.
The notes on Burroughs on the one hand and the letter to Watson on the other.
Oh, you're saying both articles, both writings.
Both writings by McLuhan
at the same time.
Yes. And both of them define what Nietzsche means by the cul-de-sac. Because what both of them set out is that the artist, and the artist here can be the scientist, It can be just somebody at a bridge club telling us what he or she thinks of the world. The artist takes up the Egyptian stance of defining the world. And the presupposition which Nietzsche saw was that that artist must him or herself be real in order to do that. And if that reality is taken away from the artist, then everything falls apart, and that's what the cul-de-sac is. And here's McLuhan in 1964 writing to Watson where he says just that. He says that the artist wants to be this pope that dictates what the reality of things is, and that's ridiculous, right? And he says that's what Joyce wanted to do, that's what Lewis wanted to do, that's what Yeats wanted to do, that's what Pound wanted to do, and McLuhan is indicating his disagreement with that.
Yes.
And I believe what he's saying is that if the artist, instead of being the director of reality, is the receiver of reality's plural.
Reality's what? Whirl or swirl?
Plural.
Plural.
Not singular.
Reality's plural.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Not singular, but plural.
Yeah.
It's the role of the artist to find one of the percepts that are incoming that avoids or gets out of the cul-de-sac.
Right. Now, let me, when I read this Notes on Burroughs, you know, many times through the years, I eventually realized that Joyce and Burroughs were panic. He's saying they're panic media ecologists. They want to turn off the present environment. Now, McLuhan, he's a little more flexible. He says, we don't need to turn it off with finality. We just turn it off for 6 months and then note the services and bring it back on. And so I thought it's the only time when he confronted a media ecologist equal to what you would think McLuhan was about. If you're a neo-postmanite guy, let's turn off TV, get rid of it for a long time. That's a panic media ecologist. And McLuhan is pointing out his vision is different from Burroughs and Joyce because he's not a panic media ecologist, and he wouldn't hit the off button. That's what the shut on button or something he says in that article.
Mm-hmm.
He wouldn't panic like them. He'd turn it off.
Correct.
For a few months. In other words, McLuhan has the advantage that after the bomb, after World War II, the panic of culture moving into the 1940 period, McLuhan knows we survived it. And he knows we got a whole bunch of newer, different problems, a different kind of softer cul-de-sac, you know, cool television and that, and then the satellite environment. So have you noticed that? When McLuhan is the contrarian, if you bring in someone close to him, he'll bring out another aspect of himself that he never says. He hasn't seen.
Mm-hmm.
You get what I'm saying,
right
there?
So, absolutely, I get what you're saying. But as usual, there's the difference between you and me that I would put it in terms of all at onceness, whereas what you say is he's not panicking. He's turning off television, let's say, for 6 months or 3 months or something.
Yeah.
So you would say it's not long. You would say,
yeah.
The media are compatible enough with each other that only a temporary dislocation is needed.
Yes.
So, and the way I would rephrase that is I would say these media are contemporary. They have the same time, right? It's all at once. And so what's necessary to get out of the panic is to realize that the metaphor or the transformation or the tactility between these media is
ecological. Ecological.
Yes, absolutely. Or electric. Or
yes.
Right. They're in touch with each other.
Now I indicate that probably these quotes come after, but remember he says in the mid-60s that for the first time, humans are not conditioned because they move from one kind of environment to another and they don't get stuck in anyone, and the multi-shifting creates a new detachment. You know where that quote is? Do you know what I'm referring to in here?
Oh, absolutely. That's a no. I don't recall it in the book, but it's certainly a very important aspect of McLuhan's thought. He talks about that in the middle 40s when he begins to talk about the maelstrom, and then he says that specifically in the preface to Mechanical Bride. So you're absolutely right that that's a very important component.
Yeah, let me find it. What's a word that's in it? See, if I just put my search button in. Can you think of a multi for the first time? Maybe something like that. For the first time. Let's see if that gets me there. Yay, it did. It worked.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, so let's see what page is that. It looks like 128.
And is that PDF or print?
PDF.
Okay.
I mean, PDF, this is what I get when I go to the New Aspirations Journal and click on that one. That's PDF, right? When you say print, what is that?
Well, the print page is the number at the top of each page, and the PDF page is what you can change on the bar at the top. You know where the arrows are for going up and down?
Okay.
So right beside that is the PDF page. So you're talking about the print page or the PDF page?
The PDF.
Okay, so that's 126, and here's the quote from Notes on Burroughs again, or?
No. I'm on page 128. 128.
Okay. Yep.
Okay. So, what are we both looking at? The PDF.
Yeah, that's. This is the quote from Prospect.
Yeah, let me read it.
Go ahead.
And this is in 62. This is before Burroughs.
Yeah.
He says, and I think it is this, and he's saying this to an art magazine. So he gets his most inspired things, it seems, or, you know, unique things in for art environments, for art audiences. They bring out the more interesting McLuhan. So he says, and I think it is this multiplicity of media that is now enabling man to free himself from media for the first time in history. What an amazing sentence. He has been the victim, the servo mechanism of his technologies, his media from the beginning of time. But now, because of the sheer multiplicity of them, he is beginning to awaken because he can't live with them all. There's your simultaneousness, all at once-ness. So, see, this is an amazing quote because this is where the environment is the artist, the sculptor. We are becoming awake not by any art objects. And in this mid-60s, he's always saying how ridiculous the art object is. So the art process, he said, mimes the act of learning. He makes a lot out of the learning process is in our environment. You know what I mean there?
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
In fact, that's what we've been talking about, but I'll explain that in a little while.
Right. So here's Finnegan's had become awake. Maybe Joyce saw that. Joyce may have seen this process that Marshall's spelling out here, but it would be riddled with doubt and all the problems that Joyce had himself in his career and his personal life. Here's McLuhan, a more relaxed position, can see this without much personal agony that Joyce was going through. But it may include what Joyce was showing. The process, as Barry Nevin said on page 197 of Take Today, where They say the recent retrievals of tribal unconscious are now replaced by the recently achieved forms of consciousness. And I asked, what are the recently achieved forms of consciousness? And he says, Finnegan's Wake. Now, granting Barry the same awareness as a good student of McLuhan's, that he got to this point, you know, maybe 1972, 10 years later, so he understood what McLuhan was saying in 62, and he was telling me the process that had been externalized in an ecological interplay in the global theater was leading to this incredible awake condition, or what McLuhan called collective consciousness, not collective unconsciousness. These are the ideas I've meditated on for 50, 40 years. You know, these quotes mm-hmm. and these mm-hmm. points.
Right. But notice, Bob, how this actually recapitulates what we were talking about before. Because what happens when a person becomes free of the multiplicity of media is not that suddenly the media become sort of transparent to him or her, right? It's rather that there's a change in the direction of media. Instead of media controlling how things are seen or heard or smelled, now the media in their plurality, multiplicity, as he says in this quote, are perceived as incoming.
Yes.
And it's precisely the freedom that humans have situated between incoming information that allows media to become intelligible.
Now, let me respond to that.
Okay.
McLuhan is the doctor explaining to contemporary humans how they got to this awake state by default. They don't know that's where they've gotten.
Right.
And he's telling you how you got there. He's giving the prescription for the disease. He's, what is it, the diagnosis? He's giving the diagnosis. And
right.
this leads to a huge indifference to anything anybody else brings up. Because everybody's going to talk from their specialist situation, as he has in Take Today, one of the final chapters, is specialist ills versus specialist cures. He knows that we're in a new zone, a new water. A fish is fresh out of the water, as he says at the end of War and Peace in the Gold Village in 68. He is, and you know, there's that quote, I'm the only one who knows what's going on. If you get what he's saying here, he is the only one capable of saying this, and you can't lock him in. He's not a Freudian. He's not an anarchist. He's none of those categories. As a matter of fact, he's
right.
Discarnate Egyptian pharaonic being. He's in charge. He is in the pharaonic position by seeing this.
Well, he doesn't like, I mean, he's very critical of the pharaonic position in those two earlier quotes that we read.
Right. They are not conscious. They don't get there. The bomb is the exclamation point of history. He has the advantage of being after that. And
mm-hmm.
he says in that quote, the previous one, the bomb is the environment. And it's very interesting how he talks about the bomb. The bomb is an environment of information. He talks about it quite mm-hmm. differently than normal United Nations talk, you know, about this terrifying weapon.
Yeah, that's why he uses the phrase media followed.
Yeah, there you have it. That's
yeah.
other
but
factors,
Bob,
other bombs.
But, you know, when you're talking about being the doctor and making the diagnosis and the prescription, the difference we have is that I don't think he's describing a new situation. I think he's describing the situation that is always the case, but up until now has been unknown.
Yeah, okay. He's conscious. He's the first to see what was unknown. And so
yeah.
This is why he's a complete put-on, and he can say that all his communications are satirical because he's not inside them. He's fully conscious of them, and he's putting them on. And that,
correct. And so what that would mean is that all a human experience is some kind of put-on.
Yes.
And he understands the mechanism of the put-on.
And all the different types of put-on. Other people
absolutely
call them cultures. Like he says, James
right
Joyce is, you know, an expert in all cultures and can live in any one of them. That's one
that's
step,
right,
you know, before McLuhan. McLuhan comes after that. He's more aware.
Right. Yeah, but so then, now let's, this again recaptures everything we were talking about.
Yes.
If we're asking about how do you get out of the cul-de-sac, the answer is to realize that the when a person is in the cul-de-sac, that is a perception. But there are other perceptions, right? And so the whole extrication out of the cul-de-sac takes place through the realization, number one, that perceptions are plural, and number two, that any one of them is available to us.
Yes. That's what I call quadrophenia.
Okay.
Which is man's normal split condition, and especially if he's literate, he's got the schizophrenia, but the environment mirrors, echoes the schizophrenia back at him. So you're made up of four types, well, two types of split, making four parts. Two splits, two schizophrenias. The environment's doing it in front of you. Oh, that's probably another, bringing the cul-de-sac world. The cul-de-sac has been externalized in some
sure
way.
Oh, in all sorts of very frightening ways. Absolutely.
Yes. All right.
Yeah.
And so you can see the men of 1914, they begin to see that's coming. But they don't have the advantage of post-bomb world, and McLuhan does. But I like the way McLuhan perfectly completes their work. And I call them all, those four or five guys, including Yeats, vortices, because they all contributed to the Lewis scene there, besides the painters and sculptors around Lewis himself. You know, Joyce and them are working on other parts of the vortices dilemma, which he spelled out pretty good in Blast. McLuhan is a vorticist. He's carrying on those guys' work. He's
yeah,
a member of the union.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah. And so Carl Williams, or one of those guys, maybe it was Carpenter, talking about the exploration group and the division between their specialist activities, Carpenter says, and McLuhan thought poetry was the solution. And now, if you think of little books and little poetry, that's not going to mean it. McLuhan didn't mean a, you know, a couple of poems by W.H. Auden or something. Poetry was the media poetics, a new
correct
meaning.
That's what he was writing about in that letter to Watson.
Yes, and that's where you get cliched archetype. That's the theme in that letter. They're talking about how to do the book. And Watson is a pretty aware guy. And he's a playwright doing multimedia plays out there in Western Canada. He's a good guy for McLuhan to talk to. It's interesting. Carpenter's wrong to say that Marshall saw the answer in poetry, because people would think that's just that's Leonard Cohen stuff or something. You know what I mean? And McLuhan mm-hmm said in the seminars a couple of times, when a poet would want to present his poetry, he'd listen to the guy, but he wouldn't tolerate it very long. And he usually said, well, that's too long, too many words.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then he would point out that rock and roll is our modern, rock is our modern poetry. And a lot of literate poets didn't get that. They thought they were still in the ivory tower, some superior position. They didn't recognize the, well, as he says in that early 70s lecture, rock destroys the Gumer Galaxy, visual space, and our whole heritage. But it's poetry as an environment.
Yeah, I agree with all this stuff. I have a different way of thinking about it, I believe. But
you're free to try to define the difference. I'm interested in that.
Well, sometimes I feel like I'm taking the direction away from your rap. one of the things that I'm hoping to do in the course of our conversations is understand better where you're coming from, and that to me means understanding the resonances in what you say.
Okay, let me say this in response to that. You'll write that concept and percept are not so different. They're intertwined more than people, regular McLuhanites, use them. Isn't that right? Isn't that what you point out a lot?
The problem is that percept and concept are subject to the same dynamics as medium and message, or figure and ground, or center and margin. Right, these things have a range over which they can flip. So you can have a concept as figure on the ground of percept, but at the other extreme, you can have percept as figure on the ground of concept.
Yeah,
and then all of the possibilities in between those two, including the middle where they're in resonance.
Right. Now remember They Became What They Beheld, he has a visual pun, an overlay. Those things, Trump Leels, where the glass, outline of the glass can become an old lady's face. And he says, literate man flips them back and forth. He sees one, then the other. And pre-literate man does not flip them back and forth. Isn't that relevant to what you're just saying?
Maybe. If he's saying preliterate man doesn't flip them, does a preliterate man see them both at the same time?
Or we cannot conceive how he sees them. It's just too, we're not conditioned that way, that simply. Yeah, no, I can say, yeah, he sees them at the same time, but it might be even more than that.
Yeah, I agree with that completely. That's because that if we say that modern humans have reverted to the Paleolithic hunter stage, saying that is different from being that. And you could say that the disinherited children of the post-Gutenberg galaxy era are trying to learn how to be what they are.
Yeah, that situation. And that's why, and he started to see that with unisex. You know, the biological form was getting blurred by the discarnate electrified form, and it dimmed down the visual categories of race or gender and all that. So then I do the Global Village, Global Theater, Global Membrane, then I go into the Android meme. So what is that? And I think that I mean by that technologies aren't extensions of human faculties anymore. The last one was a satellite, the extension of the planet. Then when you get into this digital world and weirdness, it's the extending of whatever they are, the software algorithms or something. Whereas Eric says in his book, what's that one in 1998, the electric breakthrough, the
electric language.
Oh, yeah, electric language. He sees that the digital technology are extensions, further extensions of the parts of the brain. And I'm thinking, well, that's still an extension of the human form. The Android meme is technology extending itself. And that's the difference. This is a new problem. Don't know if McLuhan first saw it. Definitely the experience we have living in it is written, is presented in Finnegan's Wake, especially in Web 2.0, in social media. I mean, what a painting Joyce did of Web 2.0 world, right?
Yeah, I would talk about this differently. I would go back to what we were earlier talking about with perceptions, right? You're talking about the subjectivity becoming autonomous and is no longer sort of encapsulated in humans.
Right.
But there's an autonomous subjectivity. When McLuhan was reading Jung in the early 1940s, this was the sort of question that he was asking himself. So in regard to the trivial arts, for example, of his thesis, are these trivial arts things that we think about and control, or are we thought by them?
Right? Are we did you say thought by them?
Yeah.
Yes. Okay.
So when he says to his Jesuit friends in 1944 that more important than Thomas for the Catholic Church is to understand analytic psychology, that is to say Jung.
Yeah.
That's what he's talking about. He's saying if we're going to get a new direction for the Church, we have to understand these autonomous subjectivities.
Yes. Do you know the article, 1946, Out of the Castle and Into the Counting House?
Yes, I have that. I haven't read it in some years, but I have it.
Well, I was talking to Blake and Clinton last Friday, and uh-huh. Clinton, you know, has access to what we can't get access to, the 40s writings, and he's having quite a time. I think you've talked to him about it, right? Communicated about it.
I haven't talked to him, but communicated,
Yeah, and so he's familiar with McLuhan's 40s state of mind, which is quite different from the 50s. And so I brought up this article, and he checked the archive list at Ottawa, and it wasn't listed. I hadn't checked that out. And I got it back in the 70s in Toronto, whatever book it was in. Or magazine. So he was able to find it online and have a PDF, and he gave it to Blake, and so we were zooming, so to speak, and we started to read it, and they were so amazed at it that we just kept reading it, and we read the whole thing, and Clinton, who'd been trying to figure out how to write something, summarizing what he had learned from the 40s McLuhan, he realized this article is the summary. And it was incredible. All the different aspects of his grievances in the 40s were in this article. So my first curiosity was, were you aware of it? Go back and read it. A lot of my Bob's Medicology album, one of the things they used to say on the radio, Everything's Disappeared, he was saying that in the 40s in this article. Humans were gone, just as he says in 1950, Orwell's describing 1900, not 1984. And he says that in another place in Take Today, he says Orwell's describing 1934. But such a vast cancellations of human experience by the 20th century is in that article. So I recommend it because it's not listed. I don't know how I found it. I don't think it's in the bibliography. It might be, the one that Mark Stewart made and the guy in Florida. Do you know where you saw of it? How did you discover it?
No, I can't remember. It was years ago.
Yeah.
Probably in one of the bibliographies.
Yeah, but it's funny. It's not listed in Ottawa.
Yeah, that's... sometimes things there are listed in funny ways. I'll have to take a look.
Yeah, check that.
See if it's really not there.
Okay, so you just quoted the 40s. I got refreshed on what his amazing statement in the 40s was in that article, which I just re-experienced on Friday, last Friday.
But let me just go from something you just said. You were talking about disappearance.
Yes.
And the sixth step of Nietzsche's History of an Error, which is written, I believe, in 1887, the sixth step is that more or less we got rid of the real world, and we were left with only the apparent world. But with the but when we have only the apparent world, the apparent world itself is dissolved.
Yeah.
Right. And that, so that's disappearance, right?
Yeah.
So the whole cul-de-sac that Nietzsche describes is the disappearance of everything. So when you say that McLuhan goes back to the case of 1900, in fact, he goes back to the 1880s, which is when Nietzsche saw this.
Right. But then he says that's the effect of the telegraph. When Nietzsche says reality is gone, McLuhan comes along and shows the constituents or elements of reality by inventorying the media of the day. And then he says that leads to no more visual space. Is it more useful that McLuhan spells out the constituents or your chemical elements of the mix of reality than the just conceptually writing reality is gone?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's the whole key to answering the problem of reality is gone, is to say or to demonstrate that reality is gone only given certain media presuppositions.
Right. Media experiences. Media conditions.
Right. Correct. Correct. And so with other media, reality is reinstituted.
Yes.
Right? And then the great difficulty that McLuhan was trying to think is that it's not good enough to see one of these medias canceling the other. The trick is to be able to appreciate them all at once.
Yes, all at once. I get that point there, the way you're saying that. Yeah, he says in the Mike McManus interview, the problem today is the media are canceling each other out.
Right.
And so we're lost. We're no identity. We don't know how to re-put on the media environments.
Correct. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay, now, if Marshall was alive today, the implosion of the Android meme in front of us, and then the tech body pops out of it, this monstrous, amazing friend of ours that we call the tech body that put Trump in and is creating the chaos right now. It's a living, what do you call it, a demon, a golem, what is it, Typhon, that phantom before me, you know, and what a blow that phantom gave me, whatever terms we have of something that's a reality that haunt, that bugs us, that drives many people crazy. You know, they have a ghost in their home really actively disturbing their environment all the time. That's the tech body. So it's hard to describe the tech body, but the merger in the Android meme, the implosion within the technology external to us, that subjectivity that's out there, you know, Derek de Kirchhoff has written a recent essay on the disappearance of self, time and space. I see that as the Android meme phase, and the tech body is after that. And the tech body is here confronting us, and humans are really at a loss of how to respond to it. And that led to our huge cul-de-sac, right? The stopping of the economy. Is that the cul-de-sac externalized in some blatant way that affects the chemical body? Not just the discarnate body?
I think I would say yes to that. I mean, the The difficulty is that I don't see these things as phases. I try to think of these sort of as all at onceness. How can I put this? If media are elements, right? So that the medium is the elementary structure of human experience, then I see what you call phases as very complex molecules of media elements.
Okay, so would you say that the tech body was the environment of the caveman? That whatever media they had harassed them like the tech body does today to us? Is that your all-at-onceness? It's always the same struggle of something externalized that becomes an environment?
Yes, but the environment's never singular. So, I mean, if you take one family in Paleolithic times, that family was just as diverse as families are today. And then if you went out of the cave and you went over three or four caves to another family, those families would be just as diverse as families are today. So it's not as if today we have one haunting that is felt by everybody in the same way. There is definitely a haunting, just like a person can become physically ill from the flu or something like this. But it's not the case that everybody has the same flu and everybody has the same consequences from it, right? So what I find so valuable in what you talk about is that there's an aspect of McLuhan that I don't understand so well, and that is how he was such an accurate predictor of what was happening around him and what would happen.
Yeah.
And that is, and when he talks about those things, those are very complex things that he's talking about. And you seem to me to better capture that complexity than I'm able to do.
Okay.
Right? So that's like the difference between chemistry and meteorology.
Right. Okay. Which we began with. That's what you first proposed
right.
to me, a couple months ago. I wanted to say, when he says on page 11 of Take Today, he says something, and then he says, but man is still the content. Are you talking about the same man as content through all of the technological phases? Is that what you're emphasizing? The constant of man?
Yes, but man, of course, is a very, very complex thing. Saying man is a little bit like saying nature. And look at nature. Nature's got all of these elements, and the elements combine into compounds and molecules and into bacteria and viruses and animals and on and on and on, right?
Yes, okay. So I'm certainly aware of the all-at-onceness today. And then including what apparently is different times. I mean, my buddy Ion talks about the big now, it's all of it's happening.
Yeah.
I can project that into what you're saying. So
and
my alibi would be that when I write this book, I want to dumb it down for people who don't read too much to be able to read it. I'm not going to splash them with Finnegan's Wake. I'm just going to make it literally biased because it fits into how they think. Now, waking them up, I don't know if this kind of article does that. You have to confront Finnegan's Wake to be awakened. Every citizen has to go through Finnegan's Wake. They got to figure out, why would this book happen, this ridiculous book that you can't read? You know what I mean? And McLuhan explains why Finnegan's Wake happened. I'm probably doing more. If you don't do Finnegan's Wake, you're doing concepts, if you're right.
Yeah.
You can't get
so
past it.
In notes on Burroughs, McLuhan has this great phrase. He says, it's necessary today to live the discontinuous non-story.
Yeah. Now,
right?
that's McLuhan's words?
That's McLuhan's words.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a great line.
And you can see Beaujard is doing the same thing. You know, he calls it the, whatever it was, he called it the ideal something. He had some term in his later writings for the present. But it was, you know, the wrong wording compared to McLuhan's apparently practical pointing out of actual environments. And then Beaujard has that book, The Perfect Crime, where the crime is not committed against anybody, but it did happen. You know, something like that. That's like saying non-story.
Yeah.
You see, Marshall, oh yeah, that was the other point I wanted to make. You take what his vision in the 40s, and then from the 50s on, all the different kinds of novels or writings or experiments done, they all revolve around McLuhan, who lays it out very simply in the 50s and 60s, the core of the world. And then all these, like Philip K. Dick, you know, making a novel that goes back to the Roman Empire and says the Roman Empire is still in charge. You know what I mean? How he makes fantastic science fiction scenarios. But all the different types of writing, from Pynchon to Cormac McCarthy, or name anybody who became a figure at some point, Norman Mailer, Joseph Heller, they're all playing in the novelistic form with the same issues that McLuhan's doing. And that's why McLuhan can say, he could say he had made a new kind of novel, but it was a simple novel, at least in its terms, compared to the incredible variety Baroque writing style of a Pynchon. You know what I mean? His stuff is real simple. Take Derrida. And Derrida came up with the word hauntology, right?
Yeah.
He's talking about the haunting, the ghost, the tech body. So it's interesting. You can look at everybody. It's the same person saying the same thing with their unique cultural conditioning or media biases. It's incredible how the idea that there is only one person or two, a male and a female, say, that's all there ever was. It's one person, this couple, and their children, I guess. Is that's a monad view?
Oh, no, I don't think so. I mean, it's a monad view in one sense, and that is that the monad, in order to exist, has to fit in the universe somehow.
Yeah.
So that fit, which defines the monad, also defines the universe.
And that's not
right?
We wouldn't find that a comfortable idea. 300 years ago, beginning of print, you might find that.
300 years ago, you're almost talking about Leibniz, and that was Leibniz's idea, right?
Yep, that's what I was thinking of.
But it's not, but it's not at all a bad idea, because then if you say, well, this monad, how might it be articulated? And one answer to that could be Finnegan's Wake.
Yes.
And you say a man and a woman and their children.
And they're in a bed. So, it's a guy dreaming.
There you are.
Sleeping, supposedly. Yeah. But he's actually listening to the radio and other media. So you, when you read Plato, you can see you're reading McLuhan. When you're reading McLuhan, you might be reading Heidegger or Leibniz. That's how you read McLuhan.
I read all of these people as voices. Just like when I listen to you, I hear different voices and try and figure out sort of their orchestration.
Yeah, their orchestration, their temporary hierarchy. Okay, well, that's pretty neat. Right, I think we understand each other better after
definitely,
this
definitely
after this conversation. So, what would you look at next?
Well, I think it's been a disservice to you to jump around in the book because you've got so many things going on and so many hours talking to different people and stuff. It's asking too much to say, oh, look at page 40 and now look at page 63 and all this stuff. So I think what we might do is just start at the beginning,
okay,
of your book and just go through what we both think on our two sides are sort of highlights or at least points that deserve more discussion or something.
Okay, that's good. I don't mind either way. I don't mind jumping around, but yeah, we've jumped around for a few hours now in two sessions, three sessions.
Yeah.
And let's try the linear approach, I guess.
Correct.
On the surface is a linear approach. The next
That's
time.
That's right. It won't be linear because any point that gets highlighted will then go off from that into all sorts of other directions, and the linearity will be broken.
Yeah, and I don't think I'm deluded saying we're actually talking about McLuhan in a way no one's heard before.
Maybe, I don't know. I think what we're doing is we're trying to think about McLuhan and think with McLuhan.
Yeah.
And I think that's, he couldn't ask for anything more than that.
Yeah. And you feel that hasn't been done by many people?
I don't think so, no.
Right.
I think that the McLuhan industry largely exists to obviate the man.
Yeah, yeah. Which seems to happen in the information society to anybody.
Yeah.
All through cultural history. They get
absolutely
slain today. All right, well, okay.
Yeah.
We've. Do you have an idea how long we've gone?
Today, just over 2 hours, I think.
Well, that's good. We did just over 2 hours last week, so that's probably the limit. Okay, really good. Thanks a lot, Cameron. It's really amazing talking to you.
No, same here, Bob. I appreciate it. Are we now set for Thursdays?
Yeah.
Did we leave Wednesdays definitively? Okay, good. That's fine.
Thursday's better for me. Okay, I'll talk to you next week.
Okay, thanks, Bob. Appreciate it.
Okay, Cameron. Thanks a lot, too. All right, bye.